Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Aura, the all-in-one application that protects your safety online powered by AI. Honestly, it is worse to just be a human that exists on the internet from a safety perspective than it ever has been before. I'm constantly getting weird scam phone calls from everyone. I'm sure you guys do too. There are lots of weird phishing attempts that are made to internal employees at Blockworks and on Twitter. So I have to do these posts that, hey, I'll never ask you for money. It just is terrible. The actual statistics is that 1 in 4 people now fall victim to cybercrime. And if you operate in crypto, it is even worse. You are more at risk. That's why we're happy to partner up with Aura here. And I'm going to be telling you all about them later in the show. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Mantra, the security first, compliance focused L1, which is onboarding the next wave of financial institutions. You're going to be hearing all about them later in the show. But for now, Mantra, thanks for making this episode possible. All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of On the Margin. Today, I'm joined by repeat guest Andy Constant, the CEO of DamnSpring Advisors. Andy, welcome back to the show.
How are you, sir? Good to see you.
I was just saying, I've got very little reason to complain these days. I'm doing pretty well. Long-time listeners of the pod will know I got a new plant. My old plant died. I got a lot of comments. New plant. So,
oh, good for you. I was wondering. As I was in the green room waiting to be brought on, I was like, he has a plant in the back corner of his room, and I didn't notice it was new.
I got I had some very eagle-eyed YouTube followers who were telling me for weeks that my plant didn't look very healthy. And I said, this actually looks totally fine to me. And then one day, one stalk kind of bent in half. I was like, that's weird. That's never happened. And it was like every single one. I was like, no. And I kept it alive for like a year and a half. So I was kind of bummed to see it go. But the people didn't come here to talk about plants. We came here to talk about macro. Andy, just starting off at a high level, maybe we could start with this recent CPI print. It has felt a little bit like, to me, and not to editorialize, that we're starting to see slightly signs of reheating a little bit in the economy. We can go through the CPI numbers, but do you agree with that general sentiment, or what's your sort of thought on
that? Yeah, so my call long term has been that the inflation had this large reopening during a period of very tight supply constraints due to supply disruption that caused significant inflation. And that, in fact, was transitory. And it turned out to be so. As that impulse of reopening ended and the supply chain got rebuilt, we saw inflation fall. But it's always been my view that we would have inflation that would plateau at a level that was unacceptable to the Fed. And I think we approached closer to target than I expected, but I think we're now at a point where it's going to require a bit more patience before rate cuts occur for inflation to stay durably at target. And, I think the numbers are beginning to show that. It's partly, I think, due to the extremely easy financial conditions that have developed since late October. And I suspect we're going to see, inflation stay substantially above target for a while. But that's not certain, and policymakers can act. And so it's not a prediction, but that's been my bias and still is. But I would like to say one thing. Without supply disruptions and without a whole bunch more of, significantly larger than current fiscal spending, I don't expect inflation to roar back. I just expect it to stay in the 3-4 range for until the Fed actually does what it needs to do to kill it.
Okay, that's a really good. I'm in that camp with you as well. Now, there have been murmurs. I've seen little snippets here and there about, it's kind of been a narrative that maybe the Fed and Chair Powell might raise their target rate from 2%. What do you think about that idea?
I think they won't until they've got it durably at 2%, and then consider raising it. But I don't think they will prematurely raise the target so that they can declare victory, because I think the markets would would destroy them if they were to do such a thing. And, you know, that would backfire. So I think that's unlikely. At the same time, they do every 5 years, they do review their framework. And, you know, that starts in end of 2024, and they'll announce something end of 2025. And sure, they could have a different target.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense to me, actually. Basically, the idea would be that it's sort of a sign of weakness from the Fed if they were to change their target before declaring victory.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Certainly not showing a willingness to take pain in order to achieve your target if you just raise your target and avoid the pain.
Okay. So your framework, you know, if I could sum it up, is that maybe the persistent or almost like the standing level of inflation is going to be a little higher than it's been in the past. The Fed's still going to do everything they can to get it down to 2%, but then maybe they'll let it drift higher a little bit after that. Is that about right?
Yeah. I don't know that they will do everything they can to get it to 2%. I think they will, but that'll potentially put in jeopardy their full employment mandate. Right now, it doesn't seem like much risk as Governor Waller said, what's the rush? It doesn't seem like there's a rush to ease, but we'll have to see. This is where it gets difficult. It has been easy up till now. This is where it gets difficult.
Can you say a little bit more about the easy financial conditions that we've had since October? And just if the Fed hasn't accomplished their mission, I know they've got to weigh headline inflation against unemployment, but you know, if they haven't even accomplished their mission so far, and maybe they're starting to suspect that inflation is going to be a little bit more persistent than they ultimately like, why are we talking about rate cuts at all by the end of the year?
Right. And the answer to that is you have to project. They've said they are going to start cutting before it gets to target. And that makes sense, because if you don't do that, the economy has a certain set of a bit of momentum. And if you wait till 2%, you're going to see it go past your target on the downside. So I get that idea. And that's a sensible idea that, you know, it's like we know we need to stop a mile away, but we're going 30 knots in a battleship. You take your foot off the gas before you get to, you know, you put your foot on the brake before you get to a mile, you know, half a mile out, and you can't stop. So I get that. But there's this economic momentum idea. So then the question is it time to start easing back? And what I think about, the economy and why I think the Fed pulls on the short-term rate lever is because nobody, at least in this economy, and certainly in most of the economies that we've been aware of for most of our lives, we're in more of a service economy than ever before. We don't consume big, heavy things that if you drop on your foot, it'll hurt. We consume services. And so big things, big capital things require financing. And we have less financing than we've had. Additionally, most of the financing that was done when people did borrow to consume on capital goods was done at a longer-term fixed rate. And housing still is like that. And so the economy just isn't that sensitive to short-term interest rates. Banks typically are very sensitive to short-term interest rates, because when short-term interest rates are increased, they need to pay their depositors more money. If they need to pay their depositors more money, they need to charge more on their loans. Those loans are floating rate, and so they go up. But the problem is that bank loans are just not being financed floating anymore. It's mostly, most of their assets are long-term treasuries, which they bought, and mortgages, which are fixed rate. And so you just don't have that lever just doesn't do much to the borrowing rate that affects the economy. And so when I talk about financial conditions, I'm talking about the rates that matter to people who borrow to consume. And those rates are long-term interest rates. And so just looking at mortgages, for instance, mortgages interest rates in July were at around 7%. They climbed to about 8% on a 30-year fixed. And, you know, things looked pretty damn tight in October. And then for a variety of reasons I can go into, the market decided that there wasn't ample supply of bonds from the Treasury and has been rallying ever since. And now mortgage rates are sub 7%. And so that has an impact on the economy much more than during that whole period of time. They never changed the short-term rate. The short-term rate was the same for that whole period of time. And yet financial conditions have very different response when mortgages are 8% than when they're at 7%. So I consider, and most of the financial conditions indexes would support that view. The Goldman, for instance, has a pretty good one. And it shows that we're as easy as we've been pretty much the whole tightening phase.
What is your thought on whether or not the Fed thinks that they're at the appropriate restriction in terms of financial conditions?
Right. Every single one of the Fed's members, when they're on, primarily focus on the short-term interest rate and whether that's restrictive. And they use a Taylor rule. And the Taylor rule says there's a certain expectation for inflation, for the long-term neutral rate, and for GDP. And if any of those things fall, like if GDP comes down or inflation expectations come down, in order to keep the same level of tightness, you have to cut nominal interest rates. And that's been the narrative from the Fed and in the dot plot for over 2 years. But it really came to a head in December when Waller focused everyone on it. And the immediate reaction to markets was this was the pivot. And the Fed saw that despite putting an SCP, which had 75 basis points of cuts in the December FOMC, the market put priced in almost seven cuts, almost 175 basis points of cuts. And that was, again, an extreme easing, fueled asset price rallies as it looked like a pivot. And it isn't the rate particularly, it's the pivot that was the trigger. And so it really did the Fed a disservice, and they've been walking that back ever since. But that's the idea. And there's still Fed officials every day that come on and say that the financial conditions are restrictive. I don't see any evidence of that at all, except for the Taylor rule. There are a handful of Fed officials that do talk about and were talking about in October how the higher long-term interest rates, like that mortgage rate I was quoting you, had been doing some of the Fed's work for them. They've stopped saying that and actually took it out of the January statement that financial conditions were tight because on that particular aspect, long-term interest rates were no longer doing the Fed's work for them. But they really haven't done anything about that. They have limited ability to do it. And they're also very nervous about quantitative tightening and the potential that as the reverse repo program goes towards zero, that there's going to be an accident in the banking system that will cause them to have to end QT prematurely. And so that was something that was discussed in December and then spoken about in the minutes in January, and then once again in January. And then this time, Powell got a bunch of questions, and both Williams and Waller had to make speeches about it. And Lori Logan wrote a speech about it. Each of these governors talking about their desire to extend quantitative tightening till they've taken reserves down to where they think they should be, but potentially pausing or slowing or tapering quantitative tightening because of the potential risk to the financial system. And all that created easier conditions as well.
Hey everyone, we partnered with Aura for this episode to keep On the Margin listeners safe from cybercrime. I talked about it at the top of this episode, but cybercrime and phishing scams have basically become the bane of my existence. I get 10 spam calls every single day, every day. I'm sure you guys do too. And my co-founder Yano has actually been hacked multiple times, you know, knock on wood, God forbid, this past year. So it's just never been less safe to operate on the internet, especially if you work in crypto. It's particularly tough. That's why we partnered up with Aura, which is an all-in-one app that provides protection for your identity, financial accounts, passwords, devices, all of that stuff. Now, the benefit of Aura, there are many benefits, but one, it's AI. So you immediately get notifications if someone is trying to hack into your bank account, social media, whatever it is. So you know really quick. But in addition to that, what they do is they will actually help you solve the problem. So with 24/7 US-based support and dedicated resolution agents, Aura will actually be there every step of the way to help you resolve whatever is happening on the fraud front. And for a limited time, because Aura just loves On the Margin and you guys as listeners, we are getting a free 14-day trial plus 55% off an Aura subscription when you visit aura.com/blockworks. Only get that discount if you go to aura.com/blockworks, which we've linked in the description. So go check them out. Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Mantra, the security first, compliance focused L1, which is onboarding the next wave of financial institutions into Web3. So you guys have heard me talk about Larry Fink talking about tokenization. You've seen the clips on CNBC. You know that Larry and BlackRock are very, very excited about this idea. And the reason for that is they're looking at these trillions of dollars of off-chain real world assets. They want to digitize those and bring them on-chain, which is going to be a massive opportunity. But in order to do that, they need a compliant L1, and that's where Mantra comes in. Mantra's been steadily climbing the ranks and now stands among the top four RWA projects on CoinGecko, which is representative of its rapid growth and influence in the tokenization space. Mantra's built using the Cosmos SDK, so they have some very cool stuff out of the box. They've got IBC interoperability. They also leverage CosmWasm smart contracts. Very cool design from an architectural standpoint. The next phase on the blockchain's testnet is Hongbai, so that's launching soon. So if you're a dApp developer or something like that, there's a lot of very cool opportunities for you. And I highly recommend that you click the link at the bottom of the show notes. I don't know that I sent you. Thanks very much again, Mantra, for making this possible. And again, guys, click the link at the bottom of the show notes.
One of the other things that the last time you and I were chatting was, and you wrote this great piece on, I think you called it Script, The Only Way to Kill Inflation. And I actually have you organized that as a 5-act play, which I can actually... Here, if you give me a second, I can share my screen here so you can see it. But there are these 5 acts. And act one is higher for longer island. So hikes continue and they don't achieve the goal. Act two, long end yields rise to new highs, which requires a supply catalyst. Act three is multiple compression. Higher yields take the legs out of the equity rally. Act four, earnings contractions, the tightening of Act 2 and Act 3 hit demand. And then finally, you have Act 5, which is recession island, equity sell-off, companies fire workers, unemployment goes down, etc. It looked for a little while like we were moving into Act 3 of that play, but it sort of looks like that's been delayed. Can you give us your...
100%. So this script was written in July of last year. The supply catalyst came when the Treasury decided to issue a significantly increase the amount of long duration coupon bonds that they were going to issue. And all of a sudden, longer end yields began to rise. They peaked at around a little over 5% on 10s and 30s. And sometime middle of September, the equity market started following yields, bond prices lower, and that created both an increase in yields and an increase, a decrease in multiples. And so we were solidly in Act 3 until Halloween. And Janet Yellen decided to not, and by the way, totally reasonable. Bond yields, when she decided to issue all this coupon bonds on July 31st, had gone up by 115 basis points sharply. And so she decided, okay, we'll take a break. We're not going to increase coupons quite so much. We're not going to increase them at all. And the market just said, gosh, we can absorb that supply easily. You should have given us more. And of course, that meant interest rates fell, equity prices rallied, and here we are back in Act One. And I said literally that day, you know, Janet has rewound the script to Act One. And I think we're actually, given the way bonds are trading, they're not quite as low in yield as they were last July. There are a lot of bonds sloshing around as a supply catalyst, like the accumulation of what is now about $500 billion of coupon, new money coupon issuance per quarter is a supply overhang. And yields are starting to rise. They're well off where they're well higher than where they were when this was announced in on January 31st. So I think we're in Act Two, but the multiple compression is nowhere yet to be seen.
It has probably surprised a lot of the commentators, I think, that frankly, equities have done so well within the last couple months, right? It's sort of, at least when I was looking at 2023, it made sense to me. There's some amount of reversion to the mean after the horrendous year that 2022 was. But then at least I was sort of looking at it and questioning, is this rally going to extend? And we've sort of broken into new all-time highs. And the market does seem to be shrugging off even these signs that you and I were talking about at the beginning of the podcast about, well, maybe inflation is heating back up a little bit. Just sort of feels like everyone wants to go. What's your take on that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think clearly equities have been doing great, and it's become a little bit more broad, and you know that is a significant change. But I think it's also important to look back at what actually has happened, and you know most of the return in equities for the last 2 months and the last 14 months has been very narrow, very, very narrow. For instance, this year, and I ran this a couple of days ago, this year of the S&P return, 32% of the return is NVIDIA and 11% of it is in Meta. And 7% of it is in Microsoft. And that's really it. You know, there are a handful of other stocks. And if you look at those returns for the last 2 years, not last 14 months, 18% of the S&P total return of, I think it's around 30% for the 14 months, 18% of that is NVIDIA. So there is definitely some thing to the idea that this is all about AI. And so, okay, so what does that mean? Well, it means a lot of things, you know, without determining whether, you know, AI is realistic or the stocks are realistic. It's just a fact that the market has largely been up in a very, very historically narrow way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one other data point to add to the AI story is obviously Bitcoin and crypto is back to the highs, right? Bitcoin has been making new all-time highs as well. Now, I would put myself in the camp of I'm probably in this true believer camp that I'm a big supporter of that, but I also am a realist and I understand how the rest of the market views that. And I'm deep enough in the ecosystem to know a lot of the stuff that is going up right now doesn't make an enormous amount of sense. So, you know, when you pair those two data points together, maybe it does point towards slightly frothier rally than.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know anything about Bitcoin, really. You know, I'm just an amateur on that. But when I look at it and think, you know, when I was trading around 30,000 and sort of just really sort of solidly, not much volatility, not much anything, I was thinking, you know, it really has become responsive to financial conditions like a digital gold. And I thought that was great. I thought it was great for Bitcoin. And for whatever reason, both gold and Bitcoin and silver and other precious metals, the precious metals broadly, have all gone up a lot in the last few months. The specifics on Bitcoin, you know, the flows on Bitcoin, it's the ETFs, all that sort of stuff are super exciting for people that know, but not for me. It does seem like that there is a bit more froth than it being digital gold again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so that may be well deserved, but it's significantly outperforming what I consider its base value, which is the value of it as money. Mm. And so, why? I think it's consistent with easy financial conditions.
It certainly looks like that. I was looking, you know, I mean, you are much more of a student of markets than me, and I was just trying to get a sense of how long. I mean, you know, last time you and I were together, we were talking about term premium compressing. And if you look at the yield curve has been inverted, the twos and the tens have been inverted now since, you know, for coming up on 2 years. And I guess I'm just curious, you know, with the full span of history, I mean, how I sort of had 18 months in my rattling around my brain as that's typically, you know, post a yield curve inversion. That's when we get a recession. Is it abnormal for the yield curve to be inverted for this long without any like much negative economic activity? What do you think?
That takes me back to the thing we started with, which is long-term interest rates just are not restrictive.
Yeah.
So the reason why yield curves get inverted and then the economy goes into a recession is because the inversion makes it very unattractive to own long-term treasuries. And so their yields rise. So the way the disinversion occurs is through what's called a bear steepener, where the long-term yields rise while the short-term yields stay fixed. That's typically what literally the Fed is trying to do when they raise short-term interest rates is make long-term interest rates go up. And they've failed to, and I describe that as being a supply problem that has been undermined by the form of QT that they decided to use. And the Treasury's decision to use bills, tap the RRP, and all those things. And so my view, and this is where the script comes in, my view is you don't get a recession until you raise long-term interest rates. And that's the goal of the rise in short-term interest rates. Now, most people will say, well, you know, what usually happens is not a bear steepener. What usually happens is the Fed breaks something and is forced to cut rates and you get a bull steepener. And that's what causes a recession. It's the breaking. And that's true mostly. And all cycles in which you raise interest rates, short-term interest rates enough so that banks become in trouble and credit becomes in trouble because they can't afford to pay off their loans, that's when you have the financial system break. And it's happened. 2007 was obviously the big case, but 2001, in 1994, in 1989, in 1987, well back to the beginning of my career, financial markets break before the long-term interest rates rise. This is just not that kind of environment. There's nothing to break. Banks have had some duration exposure, which a few of them broke, but not much. But the major banks, the major financial institutions, and the major corporates, even the less major corporates, financed all their debt when interest rates were very low and built capital, principally due to the GFC, built capital ratios up in the banking system, and so are very resilient and just aren't going to break. And so I think this cycle ends when you get the bear steepener, and that causes the economy to slow through the script that I describe. But, you know, we don't know. We may get a magical disinflation and we may get a soft landing. And that's really the expectation now, that somehow this little blip up in inflation won't persist and we'll go back to zero to target, and we will do it with no job loss. And if that happens, you're going to have a Fed that cuts, doesn't cut a lot, but cuts enough to basically make the yield curve go flat.
Andy, what do you think about, you know, you're mentioning, and this whole idea of the Fed breaking things. I think I know what your response is going to be here, but, you know, some people would point to the troubles in the banking sector over the course of the last, I don't know, 15 months since I think March of last year with Silicon Valley Bank. We just recently had New York City Bank Corp over here had to get a bailout by, I think it's Steve Mnuchin's firm, Libertas Capital, $1 billion injection. I guess it may be an answer where I think you're going to go with this. It feels like sort of non-issues, even if for those of you who are following along on video, you know, you can see deposits at small domestically chartered commercial banks. You know, it's basically back to what it was, even post the panic of it. So it feels kind of like, I guess I'm answering my own question here, but it feels like the banking system's actually fine. What do you think?
So the banking system has what it always has, which is recession exposure to the weakest credits, which in this environment, everyone knows, is office buildings. And there are going to be credit losses on office buildings. New York Community Bank appears to me to be a real failure to manage their portfolio, to know what they actually own in their portfolio and to have it marked appropriately. It was a couple of loans associated with rent-controlled housing in the New York area. Those buildings are full of people. It's not like it's an office building that has no bank. They just marked the loan wrong and had to take a huge hit on that, and it lost confidence in management because their controls weren't good. So you're going to always have things like that. And I'm sure that we're going to have many small banks that are going to struggle in a recession with their loan book, because they always do. But first you need the recession. You're not going to get the break until people can't pay.
Yeah, really well said, Andy. I've got one more question for you on this, and that I want to actually have you dust off your old crystal ball. We got the FOMC coming up this week, and I'm curious to get a preview from your standpoint of what we should expect. Maybe this is a pedantic or sort of silly question, but it feels like, I mean, if you look at just the history of banking and sort of small, we used to have, even going all the way back to the 50s and 60s, like many, many sort of small community-oriented banks, and like up to somewhere around like 50, 60,000, something like that. And you can look at this chart of the amount of banks here in the U.S., and it's just a one-way trip down, and various financial disasters have led to smaller banks being absorbed by larger banks with bigger balance sheets. And there's some amount of it that just makes a lot of sense, right? You could view that from a very capitalist lens, creative destruction. This is just the way that it should go. On the other hand, honestly, just from my experience with Blockworks, as a, you know, we were bootstrapped for the first 5 years of our existence. Getting credit as a small business has never been particularly easy, and it's not getting easier with only having these large banks. And you know, COVID was another sort of eye opener for me when there was all that stimulus that was going out. And I just kind of assumed that corporate America, big businesses employed most people, but I had it wrong. Actually, it's 2/3 of people in the U.S. are employed by small business. And it seems to me there's this sort of problem where if you have a big bank, they're not bad people, they're not evil. It's just their customers. It makes sense for them to serve the Amazons of the world or the Walmarts of the world. And so it does feel like there's a little bit of a mismatch in terms of the job providers here in the U.S. and who has access to credit. Does that make sense? I don't know if that – what do you think about that view?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing that you have to do is put the U.S. banking system in context with most of the developed world. And in most of the developed world, there are, you know, four banks in your country. You might have some credit unions. You might have some people that can extend credit. But basically, the U.S. has a unique and diverse and broad banking system that has gotten less broad, but still has, last I looked, has 6,000 banking institutions that are federally chartered. You know, people don't understand why we don't tax gas more. People in Europe see their gas is very, very expensive and taxed very high and all that. And people just don't have a sense of the scale of the country. It's really big and really far apart, and people live very far apart. And community banks are an important aspect of the way Americans, businesses, and people live. And so I think there's, and I would say there is a very strong, and it was a lot of the discussion in the Powell testimonies last week were about this very topic. There is favoritism played by our country and its regulators to ensure that the community banking system has competitive advantages so that it can survive, because it's wanted by our populace and our elected officials to remain. Now, on the margin, is it a good idea or a bad idea? I think it's like, you know, the other things that make us a unique country is it's sort of necessary. You just can't have Chase Manhattan service the entire country. It just is not practical.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I agree with that. You know that, I was going to say, you know those like Leo DiCaprio memes where he's pointing and you said on the margin? Anyway. Treat for me.
Right.
Andy, we've got an FOMC coming up this next week. What can listeners expect? What do you think?
Well, you know, there's no surprise about the rate. The rate's going to be kept at the same. And so there's three things to look at. And those are the at 2 o'clock, we'll get the statement, which won't have much to it. And then we'll get the SEP, which I'll get to. And then lastly, we'll have the press conference. And so coming to the SEP, that's what I'll be focused on. And the message that the Fed gives will be encoded in that document. As of the last quarterly report, which was in December, the Fed projected that they were going to cut interest rates by 75 basis points in 2024. And so that's the important headline. Do they change that? The next thing that people will focus on, if they don't change it, even if they do, but is why they have acted on that rate, either by not changing it, or really the only potential outcome is they change it to two cuts versus three. There isn't a likely outcome for four cuts. So let me just step back and say that document takes 19 votes and calculates the median expectation. And so that means the 10th vote, if 10 are on three cuts or less, it prints three cuts. If 10 are on two cuts or more, three cuts or more, it prints three. If they're two cuts or less, it prints two. And six of the governors are at three cuts and four are at two cuts based on December's SEP. And then there are some extreme guys. And the extreme guys don't affect the median. They're all probably going to head toward the middle, though I think the bias is to, in broad strokes, is less cuts. They may all head to the middle, but it'll really depend on whether two guys, men or women, go from three cuts to two cuts or not. If two go, we see two cuts priced in the SEP. Now, does that matter? Well, in a voting institution, the median really matters. But that assumes that they're actually going to not have a, they're going to allow a vote that is not unanimous, which is very unusual. So they do it. It's an important data point. We'll see how it plays out. The other things are that are interesting that are, that drive that decision by this so-called Taylor rule are whether the inflation expectation for 2024 changes, which it most likely won't. It'll most likely stay where it is, which was already pretty low at around, I believe it was 2.4. And then the other question is what the GDP print will be. And it was at 1.2, which is very low. And so it's possible that rate could go up to 1.5 or something like that. And that might be enough to get somebody to flip, two people to flip from three cuts to two cuts. We don't know. And then the last thing, which you're hearing, again, with the Fed, you hear lots of different opinions, is the long-term interest rate. And that'll be seen in the, what they talk about as their long-term target. It has been 2.5 for, I think, 4 full years now. And so the question is the post-COVID environment one in which the economy is going to require higher real interest rates, higher neutral rate than before? And I think the answer to that is without a doubt. And if you add on the productivity, that boost of AI to some future, it's without a doubt it's higher, but the Fed has been very unwilling to move. So it'll be interesting to see if any of them move that rate higher. So the way I look at it is the SEP is either going to be really not much change or slightly more hawkish. And I think the press conference will just follow that outcome. Powell has a very difficult time being hawkish. But at the same time, financial conditions have become extremely easy. And so may want to do a Jackson Hole-like mic drop on financial conditions. But, you know, that's – who knows? And I guess the last thing will be any details on quantitative tightening. They're destined to have another conversation about the mechanics of when – based on what will they taper. And while I don't expect that to be in the statement, Powell will get a question on that. My guess is he'll kick it down the road because with the RRP now at $500 billion plus, there's no reason to rush. But we'll see. And so that's a full outlook for the FOMC and what to look for.
That's a great outlook, Andy. I really appreciate you dusting off that old crystal ball for us. And I'm sure we could keep going for hours here, but we gotta wind down. I really appreciate the time, as always. And I want to give a shout out to you and your fellow graybeard, Nick, who we didn't have on today. But I always enjoy your guys' content. And if folks want to find out either more about Damp Spring or the work that you do with Nick, what's the best way for people to find out?
Well, the best way is to follow me at Damp Spring or Nick and I at Two Gray Beards, or to go in our websites, which are those Twitter handles.com.
Awesome. All right, guys. You've heard Andy on the show before. Highly recommend that you definitely go follow him and check out his work. So Andy, as always, a pleasure to talk. Thank you so much for hopping on today.
Thanks, Mike.